This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, a slew of bills in consideration in the legislature. Our Dave Thompson recaps the week's news. But first, people learn in different ways. Some excel at reading, others need some more visuals, and plenty of people, myself included, are hands-on learners. And that means there are different ways of teaching. The Cutting Ed podcast explores education in the state. Pete Stenberg has been teaching and coaching in Minot for 28 years. In this excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast, host Tom Gerhart visits with Stenberg on location at the Roosevelt Park Zoo in Minot to learn how the zoo provides a hands-on, cross-disciplinary opportunity for students.
Now, 28 years, like everything, some things have changed, some things have stayed the same. We're going to talk about things you're doing in the classroom. We'll pop through a variety of subjects, but you talked about the instant gratification society. We all know about the supercomputers we have that we carry around with us everywhere. Let's start there and talk about these electronic devices and how you're able to implement and utilize technology.
Well, I remind the students, because it is science class, that the phone that they have in their hand, today's day and age, is could have ran the NASA program back in the early space missions. And, you know, we can share out with them study notes, study quizzes, practice quizzes, assignments, readings, videos, and they can open that up on their electronic device wherever they're at, whether it's home or in the car or waiting for a ride after athletics. And so they're able to utilize the electronic device as an educational tool. Sometimes it's something that we in the classroom, we have to decide whether we want to let the students have them all the time or not. Generally, we have the rule they're put away unless the teacher tells you to bring them for class that day. And the students have gotten pretty good with that. They respect us with that. And they don't want to lose their electronic device, and they understand the consequences if they're not using their devices appropriately. It'll be a visit with the office or with me, myself. But the electronic devices are, you know, used daily with our students. I share out my text reading, my quizzes, my notes, study guides, practice quizzes through what program called Edmodo. It's like education Facebook. I have a group of students that are in a class. They have to get a specific code for me. And then the 22 to 25 students all are able to chat back and ask questions amongst each other. But it is also supervised by me. So if they're doing things that they shouldn't be, then they know that I do see it, and then consequences will be dealt with. And since I've been using that over the last 5-7 years, students, they understand the consequences, so I haven't really had to deal with anything like that. And then we also use Google Classroom. A lot of districts are using that. Just because Google, you can save your assignments on the web, and the kids have access to it on any device, a computer, a laptop, their iPad, their phone. If they need to add something to an assignment, or if they're gone on an athletic trip, they can get that taken care of, get it submitted online through Google Classroom. And it's really easy for the teachers. We don't have to shuffle paper. It all goes into one class. So my 22 students are in my fifth hour. I just open up that classroom, and I can grade papers that way. And then they get instant gratification. I grade it, and it goes right back to them, and they get to see what type of grade they have. We can also let them make changes on their assignments, write notes to them, and why don't you take a look at question number 3 again on the purpose of the cell membrane. And so they can go back and possibly edit that and gather some more information. Google it. They can go out and gather information and find out what they need, and so then they can resubmit their assignment. And so the electronic world has been very, very beneficial to both the student and the educator. So look back, I used to have to use a mimeograph, diddle machines, when I first started, to have to crank out, and you'd have that lovely smell and the purple print on the paper. And then we moved up to the copy machine and so forth. Well, we can save a lot of trees now by just sending out our notes electronically. They read it on their phone, and we don't have to make 125 copies per teacher. So
everybody fighting over one copy machine too.
Yeah,
right? Those
yep,
days.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the classroom itself, and you know, flexible seating, something that's drawn a lot of attention, and that's something that you've implemented too and utilized. Tell me about that and how the students have responded.
When I started teaching the science classroom, we had four large built-in lab tables, and then we had three rows of probably eight desks that seemed like it was a long tunnel to the end to see the last student in the back seat. Since then, we've remodeled all the classrooms, updated with wiring and so forth, and now our seating, we're using tables where students share a table. We have desks that have rubber bouncing bars across them so that they can do something with their feet instead of having to sit still all the time. We have stand-up desks that the students can use. We even have exercise bikes with desks on them. So some students just physically can't sit still in a classroom, and so we have to satisfy their needs and give them something to do, yet still have an opportunity for them to learn. And if they're pedaling a bike, they're silent when they're pedaling. You don't hear them in the classroom or whatever. So they're able to use that, and they're able to do something, but yet they can still focus on what's happening on in the classroom instead of being possibly disruptive with tapping their feet or kicking somebody else's desk or tapping pencils. We know that it's tough to sit still for 50 minutes in a classroom, and so we try satisfying their needs. We have exercise balls that they can sit on, and not only are they having a different type of seating situation, but they're also working on their core at the same time because they have to maintain balance and be able to sit on those throughout the classroom, and so it's definitely changed. We used to have the single file rows with the built-in desk, and the kids would sit there with their books either underneath them, or you lift up the top of the desk, put your books underneath, and so it's quite a change, and it's definitely for the good and for the benefit of the students.
You've got students today here at Roosevelt Park Zoo. Some cross-discipline learning going on. They're also investing in their community, doing some work here, some cleanup work, getting the kids out of the classroom, doing some of those cross-discipline learning things and investing in their community, also critical too, right?
Yeah. We want to take advantage of the Roosevelt Park Zoo that we have here in Minot. It's one of the better ones in the upper Midwest. Bismarck has a great zoo also that I wish we could actually get down there. They're just outstanding educational facilities. You can take the students out and let them see the different types of wildlife that we have in the area and that we have throughout the world. Get to see it in a controlled situation. But the zoos try to make it doing the best that they can with having a natural facility and kind of their natural habitat within their enclosure. And we're able to share that with our students and have them make different observations. And in science class, we do a lot of classification and comparing and contrasting with the different types of animals. And so I'll use that throughout the school year, referring back to our zoo trip for the next 8 months, The math department, they're going to be doing, they do a lot of square footage so we'll use how big is South Africa where, some of the different animals roam. So they'll have to figure out the actual square miles that a certain animal will have for its range and perimeter of their facilities and also with their enclosures that we have here. And then we also have our language arts department. They'll go and start up a textbook and do many books. And in the past, we've taken them down to first and second grade classrooms and have them read the textbooks with the ones that they've created in the language arts class. World geography, able to tie that into their cultural studies that they're having within the classroom. So all of our classes, even the physical education and the music and so forth, we're all developing some type of lesson or lessons that we can use to tie in with our zoo trip. And a lot of times it gets the students wanting to come back to the zoo. Today, I had a student come up to me on when we first got to the zoo saying, this is my first time here, and he's lived here for quite a few years, and for him to be able to experience it here, I think he's going to really enjoy it, and maybe he'll get his family out sometime soon or next spring when it opens up back again. So great educational facility. We're trying to tie it in, and we are tying it in with our classroom at Jim Hill. And like I said, we'll use it throughout the remainder of the school year. So one day learn extends into 8 more months of learning.
Talk about IEPs and how you're able to meet kids where they're at and what kind of a difference that's made in teaching and learning.
Well, I definitely think that the number of IEPs or individual educational plans have we've gotten more of them throughout the 27 years, or starting my 28th year now that I've been teaching. But that's one thing that we're trying to do. We're here to educate everybody, and we're trying to find what will be successful for each student. And so when we have an IEP, there are some guidelines that we have to follow, and we're trying to find the best learning situation for every student and make some modifications and follow some different guidelines that are given to us. And they're out there just for the benefit of the students. And that's why we get into this career, is to benefit the students, the lives that we're going to be dealing with throughout the, you know, the 9 months of a year. And we want to have them have a successful school year. So we're just trying to make it better for them. And so we form an individual education plan for certain students, and we're trying to make it the best educational situation for them. So it's just one of the things. It's another meeting sometimes, but it's definitely something that we need to take advantage of and you know, help the student grow.
Social and emotional learning, also incredibly important and maybe more in focus now than in the past. And you know, I've seen sources of strength schools as examples. And how are you and others at Jim Hill and the Minot Education Association and statewide working to meet those needs of students, the social and emotional aspects?
Well, there's several different programs. One that we just recently started, and it's nationally recognized now, it's Sources of Strength, which was started from a gentleman down in Bismarck. And we're trying to help other students with creating mentors and mentees throughout the classes and throughout the schools. Try coming up with a way where some students can get some added support if they're not getting the support that they need at home, or if they need somebody to talk to. We want to have students there for the kids to be able to talk with their own peers. We also have teachers that are being trained in this monthly, and also administrators and counselors, and it's out there to help with their mental outlook, their spiritual outlook, their physical outlook. If you ever get a chance to take a look at Sources of Strength, it's a wheel that deals with like 8 different subjects, just to have better personal growth, personal health, a lot mentally and physically, and it's something that suicide seems to be popping up more and more with some of the students' lives, and seems like more students have know somebody that is, and that's one of the things that we try dealing with. You know, we try talking to the students and try getting help out there for everybody, and these are just some of the things that we're using now in the school districts and throughout statewide. Definitely beneficial. I wish we could get more students to be more mentors, but as it gets going, we're only in our probably year and a half into it now, and so it's a growing situation. But anytime we can help somebody, help a student, help a teacher, help a, you know, family members, because the kids will take some of this stuff home and share it with their family, and maybe that'll help the situation at home too. So that's what we're there for. That's what we're trying to instill across the kids. And like I said, 7th grade life science is the most important thing they're going to get out of their 7th grade year. But if we can get them feeling comfortable about themselves, about their home life, knowing that somebody's out there to help them, that somebody has their back, somebody's there to give them support if they need to, you know, that's why we educate.
Finally, just going over some of these 21st century skills you're presenting to your students and giving them to move upward and onward with, in a big picture, what are some of the things that are most critical to you?
Well, I want the students to be able to learn how to learn. They're going to run into situations where they have to problem solve and they have to get themselves out of a jam. And so we want them to start thinking outside the box, be entrepreneurs and be excited about learning and be able to support themselves once they graduate from high school and on to college, or maybe they don't go on to college. There's a lot of different things that they can go out on their own, and especially with the today's technology, you can start up your own business on your own if you wanted to, be creative, and so we want to give them the skills to be successful. Some of it's going to be traditional book work, where they're going to want to go into the universities and continue their education there, but some of it's going to be out in the job force, where Bakken, the oil is big here. So some of those students that aren't necessarily interested in continuing their college careers, we want to have them ready to be able to go out and be socially, emotionally, and mentally prepared to go out and work in the oil business if they need to, and work out in the oil patch. And we want to give them the skills that they're going to require for that, be prepared and find out, economically, what are they going to need to know to live on their own. What are the things about having to take care of their own laundry, buying a car and getting insurance? A lot of times they don't know all the things that are involved in owning your car. You got to do general repairs, and you got to fuel it, and you have to buy insurance, and you got to be responsible for it. And, you're behind a vehicle that can possibly take a life, and we want to make sure that they're prepared for that responsibility and be conscious of it. And when they get out in situations, stop, think, and ask themselves, is this the right thing to do?
Pete Stenberg, teacher at Jim Hill Middle School in Minot, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Cutting Ed Podcast.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate it. And thank you for coming out and enjoying the zoo with us. And hopefully you had a good time.
That was Minot educator Pete Stenberg and Cutting Ed podcast host Tom Gerhart. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Tom Ezern is next.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we wish President Jefferson a very happy New Year.
Can you contrive to make this program about things that happened on the first day of January in Jefferson's life?
And some very notable things did happen on the 1st of January.
Well, he married his wife, Martha Wales Skelton, on January 1st, 1772.
And suffered through the heaviest snowfall in years, 3 feet of snow, to get to Monticello.
Then he responded to the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, on January 1st, 1802, as president, and wrote his famous letter about Wall of Separation.
And also on the 1st, he received a letter from John Adams, and it was the beginning of their reconciliation.
They had been at odds for a long time, but Adams wrote Jefferson with a couple of pieces of homespun enclosed, January 1st, 1812.
So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In weather like this, what's better than curling up with a blanket, cocoa, and a book? Do you like to dog ear pages or make notes in the margins, or just like the sound a brand new book spine makes when you crack it open to smell the pages? Well, whatever you like about the tactile experience of books, you're in good company with historian Tom Ezern. Here's this week's Plains Folk essay, River of Stories.
Notes from a Winter Diary. Awaiting rosy fingers on the eastern horizon, I make a prayer of thanks for the morning dark, the story quiet, and the companionship of this interlude. Not a creature is stirring, not even Angie the history dog. So what is this pre-dawn companionship of which I speak? There's fire. The two fireplaces warm my two centers of gravity. The study, with its bison chair for reading and its cherry work tables for writing, and the north room, with the grandpa chair and hickory floors that glow in the firelight. And there is print. Wherever I preach these days, classroom, library, radio, cafe, elevator, I talk print culture, the importance of print on paper, in the definition of people and the enrichment of life. I'm standing on solid ground here. We know from Benedict Anderson's landmark work, Imagined Communities, that it is print culture which makes nations. I know from personal experience, as well as catechism class, that a relationship with print, say, a reading of the Gospel of Mark on a winter morning, also defines an individual. Here is a profound blessing to an old guy to awaken in a house warmed by fire and populated by books. This morning, I have flown in a crop-dusting airplane with David Vail via his excellent new work, Chemical Lands, and met the Marquis de Moray with Bertha Palmer via her classic love letter to the land, Beauty Spots in North Dakota. I wish I could pour each of them a cup of coffee. I think a great conversation would ensue. Or maybe it already has. Or maybe the conversation is ongoing, at least so I hope. Going confessional, I admit to a bias honestly acquired for print culture. To say otherwise would not be Lutheran. Think about the date of Luther's 95 Theses, 1517. It was Gutenberg, nearly a century earlier, who made it possible for Luther's scrawl to go viral. Drawing on another line of personal print culture, I will say, now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this culture or any culture so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Print culture is so embedded in the faith and in the republic that I find it hard to conceive of either without it. It heartens me that books made with ink on paper, are enjoying a remarkable resurgence in the 21st century. Also, that print culture, that's a thing, print culture, both as an expression and as an object of study. Print culture has become a flourishing field of inquiry at the intersection of history, literature, and communication. I know it behooves me, as a scholar of the prairies, to speak to this emerging consciousness. A key finding in the scholarship of print culture is that no new mode of communication eradicates the previous mode. Neither print nor electronic communications eradicated orality. I say, speaking to you by radio. Nor should it have been surprising that print has sustained and resurged in the digital era. We are buying more books than ever, and buying many of them online. Today, I fear more for oral culture than for print culture. Young people are stilted storytellers. And the Great Plains, our country, is not so much a sea of grass, although print culture generated that metaphor, as it is a river of stories.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, a movie review from Matt Olien. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Grand Forks state senator has introduced a bill which would allow a spouse of someone serving in the military and who has a professional license in another state to be granted a North Dakota license. Republican Scott Meyer says all of the secretaries of the armed forces branches have written to the states asking that these licenses be considered.
They're starting to use that as a metric when they start to determine, if they're going to bring future missions to those bases or look at base closures. So dealing with civic leaders in Grand Forks, Minot, and even in the state, we've been talking about what we have to do to address this. So that's where this bill came from.
Meyer says Governor Burgum has also pushed for this to happen. He says he's encountered some resistance from North Dakota's professional licensing boards.
And I was anticipating that. And that's where I would just say, hey, let's get together, we'll sit down, and let's determine, what makes everyone, work for everyone.
No hearing date has yet been set. Governor Burgum continues working to sell his idea for a Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora. Burgum has been pleading with lawmakers to help pay for the project with $50 million in interest from the state's legacy fund.
We have an opportunity to get the National Park Service to spend tens of millions of dollars improving Painted Canyon, the visitor center, and everything there, because this is a library, it's a new visitor center, it's a museum, this is going to be something that's going to help pull the 4.1 million visitors that go to Mount Rushmore every year.
Burgum calls the library a great economic investment for the citizens of North Dakota. The library is being developed by a private foundation. Burgum says the state money would be matched by $100 million in private fundraising. And some of Minnesota's finest auctioneers put their unique vocal talents to the test at the Courtyard by Marriott in Moorhead. The 31st annual Minnesota State Championship Auctioneer Contest pinned the best of the best in the state against each other to see who would take the home the title. Dave Thompson, the 2017 Minnesota State Champion Auctioneer and the Vice President of the Minnesota State Auctioneers Association, says winning the title takes a lot of patience and perseverance, but keeping the art of auction calling alive is something they take pride in.
A lot of practice in my mind. I like to practice a lot, and of course you got to learn the articulation of not only the bid call but also the business world. You need to know how to work with the folks and get them to understand that auctions are the best method of marketing.
Scott Milik, an auctioneer based in Ohio, took home this year's championship. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, that teletype can signify only one thing, that our news hound, news director Dave Thompson, is in studio to go beyond the headlines. Dave joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks as always.
Glad to do it, Ashley.
Lots of bills under consideration. Yeah. Let's start with one prohibiting smoking in vehicles carrying kids under the age of 9. Looking at a $25 fine here.
Right. And Representative Pam Anderson from Fargo is the one who came up with the bill. She said that this is based kind of on what they did 2 years ago with the restraint seats, that if the kids are not in restraint seats, I think it's up to the age of 9, mm-hmm. the driver could be pulled over and fined. And she was thinking, you know, it's not safe. This is her opinion, is not safe to have somebody driving and smoking with kids 9 years or under in the car. She wanted to do it for all minors, anybody the under age of 18. But she figured that the legislature might go with nine and below.
Are there any restrictions right now for age?
Not right now that I know of.
Okay. The bill looking to create a rainy day fund for human services for health departments. What is this?
Well, it was based on the idea that K-12 has its own rainy day fund, and there's a budget stabilization fund that if, you know, things go south like they did 2 years ago, mm-hmm. that they can dip into those funds and make agencies flat instead of going through the allotment process. And the idea was to get this fund built up so that you don't have to cut funding for nursing homes or funding for some Medicaid services, things like that, that will affect, as the sponsors say, the more vulnerable among us.
And who are the sponsors?
Senator Mathern is, and also Senator Judy Lee from West Fargo. They've got quite a few that's a bipartisan bill. Okay. And they think that there's a lot of support for that.
Okay. Have you heard much from opponents? I didn't see
much listed.
I haven't heard anything
from opponents on that.
Okay. Is this up for a hearing at all? Or
not yet. Not yet.
Okay. Okay, here's an interesting one that's kind of gone up and down in the legislature and in discussion in the past few years. North Dakota House passing a blue law repeal. So mm-hmm. this was a 56-35 vote just in the House. And so what this is businesses that were not allowed to be open before noon on Sundays might be allowed.
Right. The good thing is, well, if you want to call it good, is that the debate went a long time and they voted on it. You look back 2 years ago, and 2 years ago the Senate defeated the bill.
Mm-hmm.
But now, on our legislative review show, Senator Rich Wardner, the majority leader, mm-hmm. who voted against it 2 years ago, said he thinks that the horses have left the barn on that one. So he might be changing his vote. And it was very close in the Senate when that came up. But that's still a long way to go before that bill takes effect.
When is the Senate vote?
Don't know yet because they have to schedule the hearing first, and the hearing has not yet been scheduled. I assume that's going to be a very well-attended hearing.
Would it be any business that wants to be? Because right now grocery stores can be.
That's right. Grocery stores can be, but it would allow everybody else. if you're retail, if you've got any other business, you can do that. Okay. But it is not forcing businesses to do that. And the supporters will tell you that we're not forcing anybody to do anything here. If you want to be closed on Sunday, you can. And there are some businesses in North Dakota that would prefer to remain closed on Sunday, mm-hmm. even under the current law where you can open at noon.
Okay.
So some businesses do want to open on or before noon on Sunday. A lot of big box retailers do, and there's some others that do want that too.
Would there be any protections for workers? You know, yes, a business doesn't have to open, but if they do, can they force someone to work Sunday and maybe
right.
that's a church day?
And that there's something in law right now, but there's another bill that's going to go through to even strengthen that a little bit so that if you cannot force as an employer to have somebody work on Sunday if they want to go to church.
Okay. Well, speaking of Wardner, the Senate Majority Leader, he says that the climate in the legislature in regards to the Theodore Roosevelt Library, and he calls it, quote, a tough go.
It is a tough go. And in the legislative review program we have this week with Josh Boucher as our guest, he's the House Minority Leader, so he's a Democrat. He said in their priority list, they don't even have any funding for the Theodore Roosevelt Library.
Hmm.
So the governor is starting to, you know, appear on some radio and television interview programs, and he's got some surrogates out there working to make sure that, you know, the legislature will at least give it a fair hearing. He wants to do $50 million because he said it'll be a 2-to-1 match. You state will get $50 million out of the legacy fund, and they'll get at least $100 million from, you know, commercial groups that want to put their name on the building,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
What are the main arguments against the library?
Quite frankly, maybe it's too much of a goal. And there are some people, and I'll be honest with you, I hear this, who question whether Medora is the right place to put it. And this would be in Medora.
Okay. Well, yeah, because was it Dickinson State who wanted it? Or
yeah,
I'm
and
not
we
remembering.
Could we could go back in time and take a look at the circuitous route this proposal has gone.
Sure.
And it would take up more than the time we have this afternoon because there's a lot to the history of that Theodore Roosevelt Library and a lot to be told.
Well,
yet.
Yeah, and the argument for Medora is that Theodore Roosevelt spent a great deal of time
right,
in the Badlands and has nothing to do with large parts of the rest of the state. Is that right?
That is correct. And also, you've got the park there. And they point to Mount Rushmore gets about 4.1 million visitors. So if you had the TR Library and Museum in Medora, you'd probably attract more people to Medora.
Sure. But typically they're on college campuses?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. One of the nicest of the presidential libraries I've been to is the Kennedy Library in Boston, which is not on a campus.
Okay. Fargo senator proposing research dollars for UND and NDSU. I bet they're happy to hear that.
They are, and this is something that the presidents, President Bresciani from NDSU, President Kennedy from UND, were going around the state saying, hey, look, we want to spend $100 million over the next 2 years. That'd be $25 million per institution per year. And we want to get this research going because research and looking at new things coming down the pike is going to help expand North Dakota's economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily put in the governor's budget, but now you have a Fargo senator who's saying, hey, we should at least do something on this because, you know, this is forward-looking.
Okay, yeah, they're saying we got to build up the research part on the eastern half of the state. And
right, in the corridor.
They say
yes.
It's not competing with ag and energy.
No, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's what they say, that ag and energy will continue to be very big parts of our economy, but the economy has to, you know, diversify a bit.
Sure. Red flag bill introduced in the North Dakota legislature. This would be to temporarily keep guns out of the hands of certain individuals, for example, perhaps someone who is suicidal.
That's correct. And you have to apply to a court to get that permission to do so. So if you're a family member and you suspect somebody might be, you know, feeling depressed or maybe having some issues, some behavioral health issues, and maybe a danger to himself or to somebody else, then you can go to the court and say, hey, can we temporarily take his weapons away from him?
Mm-hmm.
So that is getting some pushback from the National Rifle Association, who said this is just a prelude to confiscation of guns. So there's going to be a fight. I'm pretty sure when that gets to a hearing, that's going to be an interesting hearing to be.
Yeah, I bet. How long is the proposed, ban isn't the right word, taking the weapons away, how long are they saying?
They're not really saying what the ban would be for, but it would allow somebody to go out and get treatment for behavioral health.
Mm-hmm. And is it specific to behavioral health? Are there other people who could end up on that list?
Well, it's specifically to behavioral health from what my first reading of the bill is. I'm sure there's going to be some other things that might be added to it or subtracted from it.
Okay. UND proposal, or rather a Board of Higher Education committee endorsing a UND proposal on deferred maintenance. So this is $80 million. And how does this work?
How this works is that the UND would go to the North Dakota Building Authority and bond through that. And they would bond through that. This would be bonding. And they would use the $80 million to, shore up envelopes of buildings in their core campus area, maybe tear some things down, maybe make some improvements in the buildings for HVAC systems and things like that.
Okay.
And the UND said that they would pay for the bonds through the normal operating expenses that the university would budget. When they first brought it up, they said maybe tuition increases might go into that, and there was some pushback on that.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, we'll try to absorb this in our normal operating budget.
Okay.
The idea is that eventually you should be able to get rid of some buildings. And for me, as a UND alum, when they said that they probably would eventually tear down Gamble Hall, well, I kind of sighed a bit because, I used to spend a lot of time in Gamble Hall because it was a way – we had classes in there, and it was a way to get to Merrifield Hall and to Old Science, if you remember Old Science, which is fond memories for me.
Possibility here of studying privatization of Minot State and two other colleges.
Right. Now, he said, Scott Lauser is the state representative who has introduced this bill. He said he comes in with no preconceived notions. He wants to take a look as see what happens if you privatize Minot State. What would that mean in terms of tuition, students, and would this be a better fit for Minot? And there would be two other as yet to be named institutions mm-hmm. to be named later, so to speak. And they're not classified, as he said, as research institutions, so that would limit the pool a little bit.
Okay.
But it is perhaps a way to look at repurposing things. He said that he has no preconceived notions on it, but if you take a look at some of the wording that was approved in the resolution, they were talking about looking at things like, is this going to save the state money?
Okay. But, yeah, this is just a study. It's not
just
even a
study.
Bill to do it. So
if you wanted to close an institution, you have to go to the Constitution.
Okay. Bill introduced to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. This is a bill that has failed in past sessions, but now they've eliminated a clause about gender identity and what's the feeling now?
Well, that's the House version of the bill. There's a Senate version of the bill that more closely mirrors the one that has failed in the past few sessions. So they're attacking it from both houses. We'll see what happens, see if they can get that passed this time. It is always a very controversial bill because there are certain people in the legislature who feel that gender identity comes from a higher power. And that, if you're and they also say that there is no discrimination against gay people. However, one of the sponsors of the House resolution said she decided to sign on to it because she had a gay friend who was fired from the job because for being gay. And she said that angered her. And that's why she put in the bill. And I think you're going to hear a lot of discussion about that. I think it's going to be a huge hearing when it gets to that stage.
Well, Dave, we're out of time. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Madeline is next.
Women are taking to the streets again as many prepare for the third annual Women's March. Their message of social change is getting lost amid controversy over march leaders. How do women feel about the march and its message today? The effects of the longest government shutdown continue to grow. We'll have the latest, these stories and more, Saturday and Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's the fanfare. It's time for another movie review with our resident movie maven, Matt Olean. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet.
And you've seen Mary Poppins Returns.
Finally saw it. I did not get to see it over the holidays when I was going to try to, but I like this better than I thought I would. There's been, you know, it hasn't been completely praised by critics. A little bit, I think it's got about a 75% positive on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's got big shoes to fill.
It does have big shoes to fill. And, you know, some of the critics have been a little down on it, but I thought it kind of recaptured that Disney magic. You get the feeling you're watching one of those 60s musical super productions with good songs and good music. I don't know that the songs are as catchy as the Sherman Brothers came up with Spoonful of Sugar, mm-hmm. Supercalifragilistic, et cetera, Chim Chim Cheree. But there are a couple real showstopper numbers that involve the Lamplighters. And, of course, Lin-Manuel Miranda plays Jack the Lamplighter in this film. He's very good, despite a little bit of a dodgy Cockney accent. He does have a very he's a great performer, and he's got a great smile, and I think he pulls off that role nicely. There's another show-stopping number with he and Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins, where she kind of does a Cockney dance hall routine, which is very much not the Mary Poppins character. That's a show-stopping number as well. But so the story this time involves the Banks children from the original film, Michael and Jane, who are now grown up. And Michael has three kids. Jane, not married, no kids yet, but she helps out because Michael's wife has passed away. So the three kids, you know, need help, and they're growing, and there's two boys and a girl, and the kids are very charming in the film. It's John, Annabelle, and Georgie. And, of course, Mary Poppins arrives for help. And, of course, there's another drama involving the house that's going to be repossessed by the evil banker, Colin Firth. And they have until midnight on a Friday to come up with the money. And they think that maybe the father had shares in the bank, but they can't find them. So there's all kinds of things that Mary Poppins has to fix, and she has to help the children. So it is a bit of a sequel that the Banks kids are now grown up, and there's little ones running around. And Emily Blunt, I wasn't quite sure as Mary Poppins, but after I saw it, she did do very well as Mary Poppins. She's a little more cool than Julie Andrews was in the role, a little more. When I say cool, I mean she's more stern with the kids than maybe Julie Andrews was. But she's very delightful. Her dance numbers are great. I think she's going to get a Best Actress nomination. The choreography by Rob Marshall, who's the director, is great in this film. And he, of course, directed Chicago. He has a lot of directing and choreography skills in his background. The big numbers still come off, I think. And is there anything better than Dick Van Dyke saving the day?
He's
93
so
years old, dancing on a desk. I won't tell people how he appears and what he does because that's a big secret. But just great to watch a performer like that at his age pulling off that. Angela Lansbury's in it. I did think the whole Meryl Streep sequence could have been cut out. That sequence did not do much for me with her appearance. But overall, I think this was a nice Disney film. It took me back to as a kid, you know, going to things like Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And I think they really did pull it off.
Is it a little kid's film or will teenagers be okay with it?
I think both. This is young kids will be fine with this film, especially if your child loves theater, loves dancing and singing. I think they'll really enjoy that part of it. The film is really seen through the eyes of the three children trying to save their dad's house, you know, trying to save the family house. And they're so charming and so good. And they look after the little one, Georgie, the older brother and sister do. So it's got that kind of family Disney feel to it. Like I said, I liked Miranda a lot in his role. I liked Emily Blunt. Dick Van Dyke's great. Ben Whishaw plays the father. Emily Mortimer plays Jane, Michael's sister. So, you know, what'll be interesting, Ashley, is to see if it gets in the Best Picture mix. So far, it hasn't made a big splash on the critics' awards so far. Didn't make a big splash at the Golden Globes either. I do think a couple of the songs might be nominated, but they're going to be up against Shallow from A Star Is Born, which I think is the favorite to win the Best Song Oscar. But if you haven't been to Mary Poppins Returns yet, it's old-fashioned entertainment. And that's what they're driving for. And I think it largely succeeds, despite a little bit of length and the Meryl Streep segment. It really didn't do much for me.
Has Julie Andrews commented at all about the film?
So my understanding is they approached her about a cameo. She did not want to do it to not overshadow Emily Blunt. But Dick Van Dyke and Angela Lansbury, you know, jumped at the chance to be in this. And like I said, Dick's appearance is... It furthers the story. It's great. People are going to love it when he shows up in the film.
This week we lost a great one.
Yeah, Carol Channing. You know, not a great film career. Most notable, of course, for Broadway, playing Hello, Dolly over 5,000 times. She missed one performance in all that time. It must have been thankless to be her understudy. And apparently the missed performance was to accept a Tony Award Lifetime Achievement. So... this is the epitome of professionalism. You know, how many shows has Justin Bieber missed? You know, maybe two a week, it seems. I'm being facetious.
Justin Bieber?
Well, no, I'm saying this is someone who showed up every single night. And that is the great thing about performers like her. She did get an Oscar nomination for Thoroughly Modern Millie back in 1967 for a supporting actress role. But her two main great performances, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Hello, Dolly, both went to other actresses when the film versions were made. And this happens. This truly does happen in film. Barbra Streisand was far too young to play Dolly in the 1969 film version. I think they should have went a different route there, either casting Channing or, I know, Ginger Rogers was interested in the role at that point. But a great loss. She was 97. And, everyone knows who Carol Channing is.
All right, well, we have some Oscar trivia, and so one of the cast members of Mary Poppins Returns holds the record for most nominations in acting.
Oh, in Mary Poppins Returns?
Yeah.
Holds the record. Oh, Meryl Streep, of course. Yes, I'm sorry.
Do you want to name all her nominations?
All right.
Because it's 21.
It's 21 now. Let's give it a shot. The Deer Hunter, 1978. Uh-huh. Do you want years or just go for the...
just go for the film.
The Deer Hunter, fine. Kramer versus Kramer, French Lieutenant's Woman, Sophie's Choice, Silkwood. I'm going to try to go chronologically. Out of Africa, Ironweed, Cry in the Dark. Cry in the Dark. Postcards from the Edge, Bridges of Madison County, One True Thing, Music of the Heart, Adaptation, Devil Wears Prada, Julie and Julia.
Oh, you skipped one in between Devil's
Doubt.
Yep.
Doubt,
okay.
Julie and Julia.
Okay.
Iron Lady, August Osage County, Into the Woods, The Post.
There's one more. Between Into the Woods and The Post. 2017 was the Oscar. 2016
the
was
one with
film.
Hugh Grant. She played a singer and she was a bad singer. What was the name of that?
Florence Foster Jenkins.
Sorry. Sorry, folks. 20 out of 21.
You're like Carol Channing. You missed just one. We've been in the movies with Matt O'Lane.
This week on Away with Words, the history of the L word.
Well, I have a question for you about the words liberal and libertarian. I know the ideologies are very different, but to me the words sound really similar.
Once they move out of their parents' house, words are their own thing. They are they're their own adults that make their own life decisions.
Join us.
I've never heard that. I love it.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Prairie Public is a proud media partner for the 22nd Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music, Saturday, January 19th at the stage at Island Park. Featuring Natalie Fiddler, Diane Miller, Nina Grohlman, Lucy Michelle, Sarah Moreau, Gina Powers, Jessica Vines, and many more.
Why don't you come and sit down in that chair?
Tickets available at 22celebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. You can find complete information on all 3 days of events at debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
Strength in our number.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 18th. On this date in 1912, the Young Men's Booster Club of Wahpeton called attention to some special rooms over the Houskin Clothing Store. People often traveled long distances to shop and to conduct business in Wahpeton. and the club's rooms offered a quiet place where visitors to the city could refresh themselves. To this day, folks who take to the road find themselves looking for a restroom, but the term seems a bit confusing. Why would anyone want to rest in a public lavatory? The earliest use of the term restroom goes back to 1856, and its origins are perhaps obvious. In the case of the rooms above the clothing store, farmers frequently traveled for several hours to get to town. They were often accompanied by wives who might have several children in tow. Once the women finished shopping, they had to wait while their husbands completed their business transactions. Towns discovered that women appreciated a comfortable place where they and their children could rest, hence the term restroom. Wahpeton's Young Men's Booster Club described the rooms as a convenient place to rest. They were furnished with comfortable chairs, there were reading materials, a card table, and even a piano. A toilet room was connected to the ladies' restroom. Every Saturday, a female attendant was on duty to watch the children while mothers shopped. Free public restrooms were sometimes a luxury back then. A letter to the editor of a Chicago newspaper lamented that shoppers had to run the gauntlet past the bar in a saloon just to get to a public toilet. But many rural areas understood that a comfortable public restroom was much appreciated. When a new building was erected at the South Dakota State Fairgrounds, it boasted comfortable restrooms. Plans for Utah's exhibit in the Panama Pacific Exposition similarly noted its welcoming facilities. The Wahpeton Booster Club assured the public that their rooms were as comfortable and homelike as possible. The rooms were always unlocked, with visitors invited to stop in and take advantage of the accommodations whenever they needed to. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's a night of music on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Main Street, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, it's the Jazz Junket with Ryan Schweitzer. And at 10, Dream Farm Radio with Julie Lavender, followed by Dimensions in Jazz with Bob Schieffer. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, it's the day our nation honors the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. From Peace Talks Radio, we air MLK, Three Landmark Speeches, where scholars revisit famous speeches in which Martin Luther King dared to dream of a world he didn't live to see. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.